Everything about Fight Week, and indeed the whole build-up to it beforehand, up until the opening bell, was an amazing experience. I mean, we've all done huge Vegas Fight Weeks. It was just off the charts big. It was so electrifying and so exciting. And it was one of the first times that I'd done a lot of other stuff with HBO. Like I hosted the opening press conference and did live streams, you know, from their training camps and all that stuff. So the whole thing was super, super exciting. The atmosphere in the arena was terrible because there were hardly any fans. Fans couldn't afford to be there. It was really, really sad. I hadn't, you know, it was become a family. Yeah, because you know how we like to all see each other at different fights, and it's kind of fun. But these were the exact same people that we went to every fight together and did stuff between fights and all that kind of stuff. And it was a great team. It was horrible. It was really, really, really horrible. I have massive imposter syndrome all the time. I carry that with me tremendously. And I always absolutely have that. And whether I'm with HBO or doing anything, I'm absolutely convinced. A little bit.
Hello, and welcome to Boxing Life Stories with me, Tristix.
What happened in the ring after Tyson Oliver was child's play compared to that one?
I still get goosebumps to this day.
you couldn't take the tears from his eyes or the smile off his face, could you?
I know.
He's bitten me. He said, well, let's put you back. And the paper, they made me look like Al Capone.
This is going to be your night.
His winning and his nothing else.
Hello, welcome back to Boxing Life Stories. This week, my guest is the truly wonderful Kieran Mulvaney. I can't say that without having a smile on my face. I've just had a really good spell at Canastota at the International Boxing Hall of Fame, working with Kieran, who is one of my colleagues at Pro Box TV News, and who I've known for, goodness, a good probably 12 or 13 years, I guess. We have covered a lot of fights together, and he is one of the few journalists who has worked across the board on all of the major networks, going from ESPN to HBO to now having the Showtime Boxing Podcast. Funny enough, as he and I were walking through the Turning Stone Casino in upstate New York, someone accosted us and said, "Oh, it's great to see the podcast rivals together." And as I say in a long-winded intro to this, which is probably my most long-winded intro I've done after sitting down with someone, I've never seen Kieran as a rival, just as a really good dude who I really enjoy spending time with. And we had a blast at Canastota. Obviously, it's great when Kieran can hold court with Roberto Duran for 25 minutes in front of a Woodstock-style crowd, which is exactly what he did. With one of the probably a career high for both of us, which was a brilliant time. And between us and together, we interviewed Carl Froch, Tim Bradley, Lucia Riker, Vinny Paz, Michael Nunn. It was a who's who, and those are all up on Pro Box TV News. But yeah, Kieran's been around. I remember spending time with him in Macau. We wound up, I think, just by chance in a dive bar in Macau where we were watching the Liverpool Everton game, and I think it was, as he recounts here, I think it was a 4-3 thriller. Kieran is a Liverpool fan, and he talks about his accent, but among many other things in this podcast. Kieran is a really interesting guy. He's written books about polar bears. He's written stories about climate change, killer whales trying to sink boats recently, the Wild West, and much more. He's worked for huge outlets like the Washington Post, as well as those huge TV outlets and networks that I mentioned at the top. And you can see why, because he's just a really easygoing, affable guy to work with, and super funny, super friendly, and very knowledgeable about this sport of ours. Before I leave you with Kieran, huge thanks to Hansen Lee Resourcing, who were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do Hansen Lee find you the best people, but they help you retain them, and you can find out more at hansonlee.com. I'm also over at Patreon, so you can support Boxing Life Stories and help it survive and thrive, hopefully, by supporting me at patreon.com/TrisDixon. We are approaching 230 episodes, which has been nothing if not an absolute grind over the last 5 years, but we are nearing 230, which is astonishing. This little idea of my daughter's when she was about 8 or 9 is still going strong. But huge thanks to you for listening. Huge thanks to Hanson Lee for supporting us. And here's the brilliant Kieran Mulvaney. Kieran, thanks for going so far out of your way to join me. We're on assignment here in Canastota for ProBox TV. But it's great. I've been wanting to do this with you for a while, although I'll jest and say, oh, geez, I've run out of people to do. But this is great. And I mean, we do jest about it, but you are one of the guys. In fact, walking through the casino yesterday, someone said, I don't know if you heard it, someone said, oh, it's great to see the two competitors.
Yeah.
And I'm like, never in my life have I seen you as a competitor, because we just get on and I see you as a mate. And every time you do something, and in fact, it came up on my Facebook feed relatively recently when you were interviewing Manny Pacquiao, I think, for Pacquiao Floyd, on I think for HBO probably. And I screenshotted it and put it on my Facebook and I said, I'm really proud of this guy.
Right.
And I've never seen you as a rival or a competitor, because I've always been pleased for your success. The bad news is sometimes you've had the rug pulled from under you.
Yes.
But the HBO thing, let's start with that.
Yeah.
I mean, that was a hell of a run and a hell of a gig, wasn't it?
I loved it. It was the best gig going, and I kind of stumbled into it. And it all started from being friends with Bert Sugar. When I started coming and started to do boxing, I got to know Bert quite early on, and we'd see each other at fights. And he said to me one day, I no longer really drink, but at the time I did. And he goes, Kieran, you know what I like about you? And I'm like, what's that, Bert? You drink. That's what real reporters should do. They should hang out in bars and drink with people and get their stories. And we used to hang out a lot. And an HBO digital producer saw us hanging out together and said, we've got to get you two are just a weird combination. We've got to start getting you on video. And so Bert and I started to do like previews of fights for HBO. And then when he passed, I took on this role of being like their digital reporter. And it was just fantastic. I loved being a part of the whole HBO deal and the whole family and being, you know, it's just a very different kind of relationship with fighters when you're working for a book. I mean, you probably know that with the BT Sport too. It's a different kind of deal, isn't it?
With all due respect to BT, though, at the time, HBO were the biggest show in town. Mm. They were the most, you know, there was a different level of gratis, wasn't there?
Right.
It was an iconic brand with iconic colleagues, with all of them are pretty much here in the Hall of Fame. Jim Lampley, Larry Merchant, George, Emmanuel Stewart,
Harold's in here, I think.
Harold Letterman, you know, everywhere you look, it's wall-to-wall Hall of Famers.
Yeah, and it was great, and I think they felt that I brought a little something different to it, and I'm not sure I could have had that role with any other broadcaster over here, because HBO fancied themselves as having that sort of extra kind of class, and having the guy with the British accent and maybe a little bit older kind of worked for them. But it was a really, really wonderful experience, and I enjoyed doing it. And they would occasionally let me loose on broadcast, and I got to do the final pre-fight interview on HBO pay-per-view when I did Gennady, or actually ended up doing Abel Sanchez, because Gennady didn't want to talk before the Canelo rematch, because Gennady was in a snit with Max Kellerman and wouldn't talk to him, so they sent me backstage to do that interview. So it was a great ride. It was 4 or 5 years with them, and I thoroughly enjoyed it. And then it was gone, but, you know, here we are.
Tell me about the team. People want to know about what it was like to work with Jim Lamb. Jim Lamb, let's start with Jim. I mean, you must have stories of all of these guys, but is there anything that stands out about Jim, who's an outstanding human being, and I guess was a dream to work with?
Jim is exactly as he appears on TV. He has, as you know, he has, even when he's having a casual conversation with you, he is having it in that tone of voice that we're all very familiar with from watching him on TV. He has the most ridiculous capacity for remembering dates and remembering details. And he sort of always has that kind of edge about him. He will get emotional. I have talked to him about all kinds of things. His take on the whole O.J. Simpson murder trial is fascinating because, of course, he worked with O.J. For ABC when he was a sideline reporter for ABC, and O.J. was doing commentary on the Monday Night Football or whatever it was at the time, and some of his conversations about like how they were sitting at a table at Sugar Ray Leonard's wedding and O.J. is hitting on some other guy's wife even while Nicole is sitting there, and it all gets very unpleasant, and Ray Leonard has to come and break it up in the middle of his own wedding. He goes, that's the kind of person that O.J. was or is. So, Jim is a very kind and considerate person. He loves the fact that there's another string to my bow, that really I write a lot about the environment and all of that. He's a staunch liberal and you know, very keen to talk about all that kind of stuff rather than boxing. And a lot like Max as well, just had a lot of intellectual interests well outside boxing, and I think that's what makes Jim such a good commentator.
Yeah, and so tell me about Larry. Obviously, you talk about Jim talking to you as though, you know, he's looking through the TV screen at you. What was Larry like? Was Larry as intellectual, constantly, yeah, as he came across? Because his sum-ups were just phenomenal, right, weren't they? On the spot.
And Larry, in complete contrast, if Jim is the consummate broadcaster, Larry is the consummate old-school print guy, right? Like, his conversations are entirely different, with the long pauses as he searches for the exact correct phrasing. And he will... during every fight week, I don't know that he knows that you can now get newspapers online and in apps, because he would always be sitting there with the LA Times print edition and the New York Times print edition and going through them and you know, looking up occasionally to have some observation about the news. Larry, took me a little while to know Larry, but he's a very, very kind, nice man. You know, he would sometimes come across, I think, as perhaps a bit gruff on TV, but he was a very kind, considerate man who I really, really enjoyed having the opportunity to talk to.
And in terms of Max, who you mentioned, obviously when Max came in, there were some hard feelings, weren't there? Because people thought he was going to be replacing Larry, and, you know, it was such an established group,
yeah,
that, you know, there was... people were dissing Max online and all the rest of it, and, you know, Larry wasn't ready to go and all the rest,
right,
of it. So Max had a hard start, didn't he?
Yeah, I think that probably was tricky for him. But one thing that Max has going for him is he is not short on self-confidence. And I think that was a role that he felt he was ready to segue into. And I think it didn't take very long for people to get used to Max, I think. And obviously he's gone on from strength to strength. And I think Jim liked working with him as well. And Max, I think, is much more of a natural kind of broadcaster. That's his background. He's not a print guy either. And I think he fit into that very well.
Yeah, and also I think Max probably did feel like, you know, if you know the Max Kellerman story, you do know that he had paid his dues.
Absolutely,
this guy who 100%. Started his own radio station in
Absolutely.
New York to do,
yep,
boxing stuff.
Yep, 100%. I remember actually many, many, many years ago, I was in New York when I was still working with Greenpeace, and we were at the UN... helping to draft a fisheries convention. This would have been in like 1993. And I was in the hotel room, like just going through the channels. And it might have even been one of these old TVs where you're like clunk, clunk, clunk. And up comes, God, I can't even imagine how old he must have been at the time. 18, maybe, Max on a cable access show, Max on boxing. And he would just sit there. It would just be him sitting there taking people, like random freaking drunks who are calling in to some cable access show about some fighter or another. And he would be holding forth by himself for, I don't know, a good hour or so, however long that show was. And you know how hard it is to carry anything for an hour without anybody to bounce anything off. And he would just be sitting there. And so he'd honed those skills before he even got to ESPN, let alone to HBO.
And like I said, there's a degree of, like, you've paid your dues. Like, you feel like, you know, it's like you've won an NABF title and now you're ready for the,
right,
big leagues,
yeah,
right?
Exactly. Yeah. And I think there was a bit of a shock when he first got that ESPN gig, because there was an assumption that when that show started, Friday Night Fights, that it would go to one of the veterans, an Al Bernstein or something like that. And I think it was a little bit of a leap of faith on the part of ESPN to get Max, who was outside of New York, not known at all. But, you know, it clearly paid off.
And so in terms of the HBO thing, while we're on that, tell me about some of the great fights or some of the best nights that you covered.
Wow. Well,
not even just that, but behind the scenes, some of the best interviews and camps that you were witness to.
Well, my very favorite, and I've never been slow or shy of telling people that my favorite fighter that I've covered was Miguel Cotto. One of the reasons for that is he was really the first guy. I really started showing up ringside around 2003, and he was reasonably well established. He was like contender / alphabet belt kind of worthy, but not yet Miguel Cotto. He's still fighting on undercards. And he was the first guy that I really tracked all the way from undercard to retirement. And they sent me to be in his final camp and to hang out with him, even for just a little bit, at the wild card with Ed Mulholland, the photographer, and be with him and Brian and Tika, his French bulldog, and see a different side of Miguel, who is never one to really open up. Is always pretty quiet and taciturn, but is actually quite funny. But here's the funny thing with Miguel. Like, when we were there at Wildcard and hanging out with him and just having the opportunity to not be in, like, an interview situation, just hanging out and then occasionally asking him something. And he would open up and he would talk because he was surrounded. He always had a very small group around him of people that he trusted. And when he had those people around him, he would be absolutely fine. And we went out and we sat in a coffee shop. What people may not know about Miguel is that he famously has a wide selection of animal-themed slippers that he wears. And on this particular day, we're sitting in this coffee shop and he's wearing mouse slippers. And we're sitting there with Tika the bulldog and just talking about his life and his career. And for me, as somebody who really liked and respected him as a fighter, to have that opportunity was fantastic. And then last time I was here at the Hall of Fame, this is just so Miguel. I went up to him and I go, "Hey, Miguel, it's great to see you. Do you want to come on a podcast?" And he just looks up and he goes, "No." And I'm like, "All right, we're back to where it was. We're back to the old relationship with Miguel." That was that little brief period where I was.
Oh, well, you thought you were besties.
Yeah, I did. And I sort of thought, I'll break the ice. "Hey, how's Tika? Still alive? Okay, good talk, Miguel. Good talk."
Wow.
So, yeah, that's just how he is.
And it's a bit of a shame. I mean, he has his legions of fans, obviously, and rightly so, for his fighting style. But what you talk about there is, you know, he doesn't give anything away. He's got that poker face, stoic, expressionless. You know, you'd never tell that he hated Margarito when he looked at him because his face didn't even change.
Yeah, exactly.
Was that a fight you covered, by the way, the second one?
I was at both of them.
Oh, were you? Oh, yeah, okay. Tell me a little bit about those two fights.
I don't think I was with HBO for either of them, but I was certainly ringside for both of them. And I remember, because I was already getting a little bit of a Miguel Cotto man crush for the time for the first fight. And honestly, I thought he was a class above.
Working for then, pre-HBO? Who would that
ESPN?
Be?
ESPN? Okay. I must have been freelancing for ESPN then, I think. And yeah, I thought Miguel was a class above. And there was a point in that fight, I think it was the fifth round, sixth round, where Margarito's trying to hit him in the corner and he's just doing some really nice, like, upper body movement, just moving out the way, and he just saunters back to his corner. I thought, oh, yeah, he's got this. But Bert, I always said, he goes, "You know, if lightning struck Antonio Margarito, Margarito would win." And he also astutely pointed out that the problem with Cotto, the way he fought, is he did have that tendency to kind of like lean forward, right, even with his gloves up. And he goes, "You know what that's a bad punch for? That's a perfect guy to hit with an uppercut. What is Margarito's best punch? An uppercut." And he actually picked Margarito to beat Cotto, and I thought he was nuts. And that ended up being, perhaps nefariously or not, a brutal beatdown at the end. And to be there for the rematch, which was at Madison Square Garden, and the place was primarily filled with Puerto Rican fans. And I remember thinking to myself, shoot, like, Miguel had better win this fight or this place is going to go nuts. And then he not only won, but then walked across the ring to just stare down Margarito in the corner. And I walked out of the garden afterwards, and there are people dancing with Puerto Rican flags, just like exulting.
I remember that night. Didn't he put his hand up in a salute as well? Like defiant, like, I've got you're mine now.
Yeah, that was pretty special.
And obviously, you know, he was making all the allegations on HBO, wasn't he? Yeah. He was saying, you know, I've got no doubt in my mind that there was something amiss with the gloves in the
Margarito,
first one.
And Margarito hated him. But
I remember, so I covered that fight, and I remember putting those two on the cover of Boxing News. I thought it was one of my favorite front covers I ever did there, with two great shots. I think they were by possibly Will Hart, who I think is one of the great fight photographers of our generation. And I put the headline was "They hate each other."
Oh, okay.
And I thought it was going to do really well, but it was actually a so-so copy, like in terms of sales. But I just remember, like, they did legit hate each other.
Genuinely.
In the sense that these are never going to be this. You know, we said that about Barrera and Morales, and they hated each other, but they became friends.
Yeah.
With Cotto and Margarito, there would never be a way back.
Never. No, they just absolutely loathe each other. But yeah, think about like the HBO stuff that I did. In contrast, I also did Bernard Hopkins' last camp. And of course, you can't shut Bernard up, of course. And I think by the end, Ed and I were actually, he wanted to go out to dinner with us. And we'd been with Bernard since, like, I don't know, 5 a.m. when he'd been jogging. And he's just like, all right, now we're going to go to dinner. And we're like, I think we've got an appointment. We've got to be at an HBO editorial meeting or something. And we were in his hotel suite for lunch. And, you know, not unusually, really, for a famous athlete. He had brought his own food, that and the hotel would cook, would take care of his own food, because he wanted to make sure, we all know how famously obsessive about his fitness and his health Bernard was. And he's especially like a fan of beets, right? And I'm not a beet guy. Beets are very divisive, of course. I'm not a fan of beets. And he's sitting there, and he's basically had these beets roasted. Like, he's sitting there with an entire beet in front of him. And Ed says, oh yeah, Kieran doesn't like them. And Hopkins is like, you got to eat this. This is good. It's full of nutrition. And literally, Bernard Hopkins is slicing off bits of beet and, like, doing practically the here comes the airplane, trying to make sure that I actually, and I'm just sitting sitting there being force-fed beetroot by Bernard Hopkins, thinking, yeah, this is one of those memorable moments.
You had a memorable moment as well with Mike Tyson, right?
Yeah.
And also, you've done a Burt Sugar impression, so do you have a Mike Tyson impression?
I do. I don't know if it's as good or as bad as the Burt Sugar one, but yeah, again, when I was freelancing for ESPN, there was a point where, maybe we'll get into this, like I said, my background is environment and wildlife, and when he had a show on Animal Planet about pigeons, because we all know that was his background. And
he did a Shark Week as well, didn't he?
Yeah, I think so. And they're like, ESPN's clearly got this spreadsheet of like, who do we know knows boxing and animals? They're like, oh, this kid.
That's a hell of a Venn diagram, that, isn't it?
Exactly. And I'd never spoken to him before. And I asked Kevin Ioli, you know, the writer in Las Vegas, do you have any advice? And he goes, oh, you've got an advantage over the rest of us because Mike loves animals. And I had just written a book on polar bears. And so to like break the ice, I give him a copy and I go, hey, Mike, I just wrote this book. I thought you'd be interested. And he looked at it and he goes, oh, man. He goes, polar bears are the baddest athletes of all the bears. they're so badass. They cover their black noses with their paws so the seals can't see them. And that was it. We were off.
Oh, it was so good. It was so good. The impression, not the story. I don't know. But it was great. And so what did you end up getting out of Mike that day? Obviously, there's been horror stories of stuff, and I've shared on this podcast, I've only had good experiences. I'm in a very small percentage that not had a negative experience with Mike in terms of the press. What did you get him going? Like, how long did you have?
I think we had 90 minutes.
Wow.
And if I recall correctly, and obviously they didn't air all of that, they edited it down. But so we started off, it was about pigeons. So we started talking about Mike and pigeons, and he would be telling me those stories from his childhood. And there's the famous story that many people will know about how Mike kept these pigeons. And first of all, he would talk about how, yeah, we would rob houses so I had money to go and buy all these birds. And then he'd stop and he'd slap himself on his head and be like, oh, Mike, the things you did. Oh, Mike. And then he talked about that famous incident where he went up to the roof and there were a bunch of other kids and they've got his pigeons and he goes, give me my birds back. And this one kid like breaks the pigeon's neck and throws it at him, and supposedly that's the first fight.
That's the catalyst. Yeah.
And he goes, I don't know what happened. I just closed my eyes and threw some punches and I guess I hit him more than he hit me. And I said, so did it feel pretty good? Like afterwards, that, you know, you'd kind of been this pudgy kid that everyone picked on and now they looked at you differently. And he just looks at me and he goes, yeah, the victim became the victimizer.
I hope he didn't use that in court.
I know, right? But it was interesting that he didn't want to talk about his boxing career. He was just not in the mood to talk about it. And so we talked about the pigeons, we talked about his childhood, and I just kept trying to poke him to talk about his boxing career, and he goes, nah, I don't want to talk about that. And he said that he didn't like the person that he was when he was boxing, and so the way he was dealing with that was to pretend that all of that didn't happen. And so I'm like, well, Jesus, I'm sitting here with Mike Tyson who doesn't want to talk about boxing. So that's when the interview got good. I threw the questions away, and it was during the Arab Spring, and I just said, hey, have you been watching what's been going on in Egypt? And he goes, oh, man, that's fascinating. And then he wanted to talk about all that kind of stuff and about life generally. And as you know, he's not an educated man, but he's not a stupid man. He's got, like, intellectual interests. And that was when it became a really good interview. We just stopped talking about boxing and stopped talking about his career.
So talking about backgrounds, obviously you said there that HBO might have wanted the highbrow English accent. I mean, you're reaching it with the English things. I mean, what is your accent? Where is it?
It's some kind of mutt accent now. So I'm born in Weston-super-Mare, moved to Amsterdam when I was 21, moved to the States when I was, whatever, 26, I think. And now it's just an amalgam of accents that I've picked up.
So it was 21 to 26. Is that a big drug period?
I have no further comment.
Was it fun? Did you like Amsterdam?
I did like Amsterdam, and there are times where I sometimes regret leaving, actually, because some of my friends still live there or elsewhere in the Netherlands, and it's a really civilized place to live. But yeah, I was 21 years old, and I lived in the Amsterdam red light district.
Wow, what an experience!
It was an episode. It was actually a really important episode in my life because I met a lot of interesting characters of different backgrounds and walks of life that is sort of out of like a Runyon-esque kind of novel, and I think that was good for me because I was like this nice little middle-class kid from suburban Somerset.
Naive, a little bit,
honestly. And so to be exposed to meeting these very freaking different kind of people, you know, there was Doris the mad Austrian prostitute who, you know, played a wares across the street, and this guy who was a dealer, and that guy. There was a lot of South African refugees from the apartheid regime, and just lots of really dubious people, like this guy who gotten divorced from his wife and hated her, but they still performed live sex acts, you know, in this place in the red light district because that was their job. And it was just, it was all odds.
When you dread going to work.
It's like, gotta go and have sex with my wife. Oh well. At least I'm getting paid for it.
Never gonna pay the pension this. Oh, geez. So, in terms of before you move away, then, what are you educated in?
Nothing really. I dropped out of high school, actually. I dropped out of school at the age of 16. I was at boarding school in England, and I was.
Where did you board? Where were you?
Taunton.
Taunton School. Did you? Okay.
Yeah. And I didn't like it. I didn't like being at boarding school. And I know what I want to do. I'd already decided that I wanted to be a writer, and I wanted to write about the time, particularly wildlife, and I didn't want to be in school anymore. I didn't like being there. And my father was like, well, don't you want to stay at school and become a lawyer or a doctor, and then you can become a writer? And at 16, the idea of, when you want out, the idea of staying in education until you're 24, 25, 26, what do you ever have to do as a lawyer or doctor? I'm like, that's an eternity away. But both of my parents had been prevented by their parents from initially doing what they wanted to do, and they resolved to never do that to myself or my brothers. And so on the condition that I went to like the local technical college, for a year or two and got a couple of A levels, they were like, "All right, you can leave." And so I left school at 16, did a year at Western Tech, and then decided to become a freelance writer.
So where did the wildlife thing come from?
So I think it's a combination of a couple of things. So my dad was in the Navy, and so I remember from a very young age looking at photographs of all the various places that he would go in the Navy and different wildlife and that. And my parents were readers. They had books on their bookshelves, including like lots of Reader's Digest and National Geographic books about our wonderful wildlife and the earth and pictures. And I would look at them as a kid. Apparently, I don't remember this terribly well, but apparently I was quite a voracious reader from a very early age. And when I couldn't sleep, not a problem I have now, I'll sleep hours and hours and hours, but apparently as a kid I would like go to bed and after 2 hours be like, "Oh, I've had enough sleep." And instead of reading me a story, my father would have me read him a story. And so apparently I was just very into reading very early on. And it was reading those books and looking at those photographs and listening to my father's stories. I'm like, I kind of want to do what Dad does and travel the world, but without the whole killing people thing. And wow. So I think it really started from there.
Wow.
And also I was a very quiet, like, I was much younger than my two brothers. I'm 11 years and 13 years younger than my two brothers. And so I was effectively an only child. And I was a small kid. I was very quiet. And I think I just always related better to animals than, you know, that classic kind of case of like the small, quiet, only child who just would rather talk to dogs and cats than to people.
Wow. Well, you know what Mickey Duff said, right? If you want loyalty, buy a dog.
Yeah, exactly.
Which in this game is, it makes a lot of sense.
Yeah.
So how did the Greenpeace thing come about, working for Greenpeace?
So because I decided that I wanted to be a freelance writer, I started doing some work for an environmental organization that I was called the People's Trust for Endangered Species. I started writing their newsletter and doing other stuff, writing about their projects. And then one of the people who was running one of their projects, which was about whaling, he was actually the manager of the Bath branch of Sainsbury's in full-time, and then part-time was doing some of this. And we were both particularly really interested in whales and dolphins, and we decided to start our own organization, which we initially called the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society and is now known as just Whale and Dolphin Conservation. And so at 19 years old, I was the director of the Whale and Dolphin Conservation Society and started going to various meetings and would meet people from Greenpeace. And they headhunted me. They wanted me to sort of be a writer and spokesperson for their whale and dolphin campaigns, and I really liked the idea of that. I mean, who wouldn't want to go work for Greenpeace if that's your interest? And that's why we moved to Amsterdam, because they moved their international headquarters there. And then one of the things that's very typical of Greenpeace is there's a sort of expectation that you can do a whole bunch of things. And one day they were like, "So we know you're a really good writer and spokesperson, so we think you're the right person to lead an expedition to the Antarctic and go and find whaling ships." So for several years, that's what I did. I went to the Antarctic on a ship and looked for Japanese whaling ships and tried to stop them from hunting whales.
Wow. What was that like then? Was that, did you see ships, whaling ships? Mm. Yeah. Did you have to stop them? Mm. Did you manage to stop them?
Yep, sometimes.
Peacefully?
Yep. And sometimes we couldn't stop them because their ships were better than ours, they were faster than ours, and they were, you know, very good at what they did. But at other times, generally when we first showed up, they would just run away and try to go somewhere else. And then after we'd caught up with them a couple of times, they'd be like, "Screw it, we've got to just keep going." So what we would do, we'd launch these inflatable boats to steer between the harpoons on the whaling ships and the whales, so that in a sense if they were going to shoot the whale, they would have to shoot us. And obviously they preferred not to do that, and they didn't want it to be on camera, they didn't want to run the risk, and so that would be how we would try to stop them.
That sounds potentially terrifying.
Yeah, it could be, especially when you're in the Antarctic. The seas can be a little bit rough, or very rough. It's a challenge. It's a young person's thing, I like to think. But the Antarctic could be really rough. We had on one of our trips, we really struggled to find the whaling ships, and we were in just an absolutely terrible storm that just coated us in ice. We had a helicopter, and a wave came over and destroyed the helicopter. And it's a rough environment to be in, and it's a rough gig. And we would be at sea for about 80, 90 days at a time, trying to find the whaling ships and trying to stop them. And I did that 4 or 5 times for Greenpeace.
Wow, that's a long way from the Las Vegas Strip, where you would have spent so much time over the years. And one other thing I wanted to pick your brains on was, you've been to the OK Corral.
Yes.
So tell me about that gig, because that's obviously, I know this is different to boxing, but it's fascinating, the ground that you've covered.
Yeah.
And like, people will know what the OK Corral is from Westerns and stuff, but they won't actually know what the background is. But you've had to do a deep dive into the history of it.
Yeah, so this was, you know, some years later, and I was already doing boxing stuff, among other things. And I had written an travel article for the Washington Post magazine. I was living in Washington, D.C. And a friend introduced me to the movie Tombstone. Are you familiar with that one?
Yeah, with Clint Eastwood.
With Kurt Russell.
Kurt Russell. Not Clint Eastwood.
Kurt Russell and Val Kilmer as Doc Holliday. Terrific movie. And I thought, wow, this is great. And it's all about the Earps and the Holliday and Doc Holliday and the gunfight at the OK Corral. And then I found out that not only was Tombstone an actual town, but that there's still Tombstone, Arizona. And so I wrote to my editor, and I said, at the Washington Post magazine, and I said, can I go to Tombstone, Arizona? And he goes, sure, what's the pitch? I want to go to Tombstone, Arizona. And he's like, no, I was trying to work out a better one than that. And so I spent a while actually down there in Tombstone, sort of becoming immersed in the history of the gunfights and of the town. And I got taken on a little private tour. So Tombstone started off as a silver mining town. And so there were a lot of miners there, and then the cowboys came as well, and people like the Earps, Wyatt Earp and his brothers came, sort of looking to make a buck and being lawmen on the side. So I got a private tour of some of the old silver mines under the town, and met the various people who portray the different characters around town, because there's always like a gunfight going on in the streets.
Yeah, like almost theater,
yes,
right? Yeah,
exactly. There's so many different gunfight shows going on, and there is a guy who's dressed as Doc Holliday who would always wander around town as Doc Holliday, and the actor's name was Stephen Keith. And I would talk to a lot of people, and they go, yeah, I've never spoken to Stephen. Spoken to Doc a lot, but never spoken to Stephen. And I'm not sure I ever spoke to him either, but I spoke to Doc a lot. And I got a really good couple of quotes. Like one person saying, yeah, this is kind of amazing, really, because this is a town that survives on death. If there hadn't been that gunfight, no one would care about Tombstone, Arizona. It would have become a ghost town, like a lot of towns in that era. And then the actor who plays Doc Holliday said, yeah, if it hadn't been for a 30-second gunfight, this town would be rubble in the desert with a pretty name. And it was just so very interesting. And the other thing that was really interesting is that still, 140 years after the gunfight at the OK Corral, the town is still divided over who was in the right, whether it was the Earp brothers and Doc Holliday, or whether it was the cowboys that they killed at the gunfight. And there are still people who get really, really, people have fist fights 130, 140 years later about who is in the right. And the
have you made up your mind?
Everybody, well, you know what? It's a great story to write if you're in boxing, because everybody involved is morally ambiguous. So like Wyatt Earp was a lawman. He was also a pimp simultaneously, for example, you know, and the cowboys were not liked by lawmen, and they were definitely criminals, but the town folk liked them because they went into Mexico and they stole cattle and brought them back, and like, yay, great cattle, fantastic. So it was all very morally ambiguous.
Wow,
which
that's
is
great.
Perfect for boxing.
Do they have like saloons there with the saloon doors and
do
they?
Yeah,
swing
there's
doors.
There's a couple that are maintained pretty much as they were at the time. Some of them have just become, you know, like a place where, like the saloon where Morgan Earp was shot dead. It's just like a t-shirt store now, and it's just got an arrow from the ceiling going, this is where Morgan Earp was shot. But other things are actually kept pretty well, yeah.
Did you have notepad and pen and dictaphone in one hand and kick the doors open?
Oh my God. And it was great to like walk along. So the pavement is all like wooden, you know, boardwalks. And to like walk along and sort of imagine that you're wearing spurs and clanking along the way that they would have done. It was always really atmospheric. I always used to love walking up and down the boardwalk there at night, just imagining that this is where Wyatt Earp used to walk or that, you know.
I remember reading it thinking you definitely got a kick out of doing that gig.
Loved it. Loved it.
So how did the move into boxing come about? What was the, how, yeah, I mean, what was the first gig and that kind of thing?
So I'd always, for as long as I can remember, I've been a fan. So growing up in the UK, so mid-80s, I was about 17. It was like Frank Bruno. And I actually even remember listening to Alan Minter against Vito Antuofermo on the radio late at night. That was 80, 79, 80, something like that. So I remember that and then listening, you know, staying up late and listening to Vegas fights on the radio. So I'd always been a bit of a fan. And I'd always also liked the idea of going to Las Vegas. There was this old detective show called Vegas, starring Robert Urich as a guy, as a detective called Dan Tanner, who drove around Las Vegas in a Ford Thunderbird convertible. And I'm like, one day, I'm going to go to Las Vegas and I'm going to drive around in a convertible. And also one day, I really want to write about boxing, because I was getting more and more into boxing. And then some friends and I had a very stupid, very viral website called WeLoveTheIraqiInformationMinister.com. If you remember during the Iraq War, the Iraq information minister was this guy who would come on camera and go, we're fine, we're winning this war, there are no Americans anywhere, and there'd be like Abrams tanks driving in the background, you know. And he became famous
nothing
for
to see here.
He became nothing to see here. He would become famous for his completely detached from reality reports on like, oh, we're winning, we're so winning. And he would have this wonderful flowery language, we will beat them all with bullets and shoes. And he sort of became, in the middle of this war, this kind of figure of fun or heroism. Anyway, so what we did, just thinking it was funny, we've just photoshopped him into a bunch of different battles through history and had his, you know, take on them. And we had this link going, ha ha, get your Iraqi information minister t-shirts here, ha ha ha. And it was a dead link, obviously. And within a day, we put it up as a website and we didn't think anything of it. We had a rugby team in England actually said, hey, we want to buy your t-shirts, but the link isn't working. We're like, okay. And so through Cafe Press, which is this online shop where you just basically upload the designs and they make the products and take care of all the sales and take 75%, we came up with a range of Iraqi Information Minister t-shirts, frisbees, panties, mouse pads, everything. One of our team was a caricaturist, so he'd do a caricature of the guy. We had some of his best quotes, coffee mugs, all of it. And so, you know, you could get a coffee mug that just said, I assure you, they will all die. And it was horrible, cheap tap, but people bought it. And we made $1 million in a month. I'm afraid to say,
jeez,
we grossed like $1 million, and Cafe Press took a lot of that, but we did pretty well also out of it. And then suddenly it was one of the very early viral experiences, because after a month we were done, nobody cared about us, they moved on to the next thing. But with that money, I paid off my share of the money, which was like 1/6 of 25%, so it's still a decent chunk of change. I paid off my car, and B, I'm like, I'm finally going to do what I wanted to do, and I'm going to go down to Las Vegas, and I'm going to spend a bit of time in Las Vegas, and I'm going to support myself while I I'm going to write a book about boxing. And so I went down to Las Vegas, and I found an apartment, and I decided to stay there for a few months and try to get myself into fights and interview people and write a book. Just generally, it was going to be about Las Vegas boxing, and I was going to focus. There were three fighters I was going to focus on. I wanted to focus on someone who was starting out, or someone who was a champion, and someone who was a veteran. And so I picked, and they had to be all Las Vegas based. So I picked Ishae Smith, Chris Bird, and Wayne McCulloch, because this is 2003. And also do interviews with all the ancillary characters. So I wanted to do a judge, so I picked Bobby Hoyle, and a referee, which was Joe Cortez, and just all the various different characters. I thought, this is going to be a great book. And sent, you know, a chunk of it around to I don't know how many publishers. I liked it, my agent liked it. We had a lot of publishers who said, this is great. Boxing fans don't buy books. and you may have an opinion on that, but...
Yeah, they don't.
Okay. And so I'm like, oh, this was unexpected. Now I've spent several months of my life, I spent all the website money, the ill-gotten website money, and then I forgot to pay taxes on it, so now I was actually in debt. I was actually worse off now than I was before this whole thing had started. And I didn't quite know what to do. And then a mutual friend of ours, Rachel Charles, said, hey, ESPN is looking for a freelance features writer on boxing. Are you interested? And I'm like, yeah, I got to earn some money back somehow. So I started to do freelancing for ESPN. And then when I was sitting ringside at another fight shortly after that, another publicist, Fred Sternberg, sat next to me and said, hey, Reuters is looking for a stringer for fights. Are you interested? And I'm like, yeah, I've still got to earn back all this money. And so that's so it was ESPN and then Reuters, and then I ended up hanging out with Bert Sugar, and then we got into HBO.
Wow, so a good bit of right place, right time. A
lot of
but
it.
also making your own, like, by getting out there in the first place.
Yes, and then I think the other thing was I realized that 90% of life is not being a dick and showing up, and I think people responded because I wasn't a dick, you know, and I was genuinely interested in learning from different people and learning about fights and showing up and working hard. As you well know, you can scan around a media room at any fight and you can tell there are people who are genuinely working there and there are people who are there for the free food or to just see boxers. And I think enough people thought, oh, whoever this weirdo is with the indefinable accent, he apparently genuinely wants to learn about boxing.
He's good with getting his hands dirty.
Yeah.
So what you said there about the Iraqi minister stuff, by the way, struck a chord because I've got a friend of a friend, a guy called Peter Shankman in New York, who did a T-shirt when the Titanic movie came out. And something, it just put something like it was a picture of the boat and said they all died.
Okay.
And he made millions.
Really?
Yeah.
Amazing.
Something very simple like that.
Yeah.
And spoiler alert on the front. But, you know, but it's amazing how that stuff works. I mean, I don't know if that stuff works like that today.
I don't know. Yeah, but I don't think you'd have the time, right? Because it was well into the war before we thought about, oh, this would be a fun thing to do. Now, within seconds of the war starting, there'd be somebody with there'd be, what, 30, 40, 50 fake Iraki information minister Twitter
accounts,
right?
I suppose,
right?
With social media as well, people share a meme rather than buy a T-shirt.
Yeah.
It's cheaper and it's easier and you get the message out.
Yeah, exactly.
So, because those little lightning in a bottle things were very 90s and noughties.
Exactly.
And I don't think they even exist today.
No. I think, the fact that we lasted a month, that would never happen now. You might get a day out of it.
Yeah, your old news within a couple of days. Yeah. So, the early boxing gigs, obviously, you mentioned, obviously, those names, McCulloch, Chris Bird, and who was the first one? Ishe Smith.
Smith, yeah.
Did you get close to those guys?
Yeah. Yeah, very much. I've lost touch with Chris. We became quite close. And Ishe followed all the way through. I remember when he said...
He's got a hell of a life, hasn't he?
Unbelievable. And I became good friends with his then-wife, LaToya, who was murdered, of course. And I remember when Ishe said to me when we were ringside at one fight, because I've been approached to be a part of this reality show. It's called The Contender, and... I'm like, that sounds stupid. Don't do that. And of course, he did it, and it was, you know, worked out fine for him. And Wayne and family and I have remained close. His daughter, actually, Winona, actually shares a birthday with me. So she's exactly 30 years younger than me. So I always remember when it's their birthday, and they always remember when it's mine.
Any other boxing birthdays on the same day that you know of?
Well, I know of. Lucy Lawless was one day earlier than me, so that's close.
I have a good boxing birthday, you know. Yeah. Margaret Goodman and Scott Welch.
Really?
Two of my favorite
people
in boxing.
That's all right. Yeah,
which is good. It's always nice to remember those guys on your birthday. So, early boxing gigs then and early boxing shows that you went to, what springs to mind? Did you say it was like around 2003?
Yeah, so my very first credentialed fight was the rematch between Oscar and Shane Mosley.
Wow, okay.
That was my very first fight, and I was way up in the nosebleeds, of course, and that was my very first fight. And then after that, I went to Mohegan Sun. I think my second fight was Chris Bird and Frezza Kendo. Not a fight to...
Not one for the ages.
Yeah, I've kind
not
of...
Not the fight
I've
of the century.
Tried to forget that I was ever there for that, actually. So, and there was a period where, before I ran out of my Iraqi website money, where I would be going to a whole bunch of fights. I was ringside for Corrales Castillo. That was pretty special.
Not bad, that.
That was pretty special.
Was that? Have you topped that?
Nah. I mean, in terms of a fight, no.
Do you think you will?
That's pretty special, wasn't it? I mean, as a fight night experience, or as a whole fight experience, the one that's come closest was AJ and Klitschko. That was a night, eh? I mean, that was to be at Wembley with that crowd and a pretty cracking fight and a pretty special event. So that's perhaps come closest. But in terms of an act, like what happened in the ring that I've been ringside for, that was amazing. Plus, Bud Schulberg, the author, famous for On the Waterfront, among others, he and his son were friends with Diego Corrales somehow. I think they were doing a movie about him. And Gordon Absher, then the PR guy for the Mandalay Bay, thought, who would appreciate sitting next to Bud Schulberg? And he thought, I'll put Kieran next to Bud Schulberg. So, I'm sitting next to Bud frickin' Schulberg, which if you're into any kind of, you know, U.S. literary history or anything like that, was pretty cool. And then to be sitting next to Bud Schulberg while arguably the greatest fight of modern times is taking place in front of you, that just made for a really, really special night. But the AJ and Klitschko, I think, would be the other night that came closest. But then when I was with HBO, I got to do a fair old number of fights. Did a lot of Golovkin fights. Spent a lot of time with Gennady. A lot of Pacquiao fights. And they actually sent me to Ekaterinburg, Russia, to do the in-ring interviews for when Sergey fought back there, back in Russia, for the first time back in whenever the hell that was, 2016, 2017.
So, our mutual friend Thomas Hauser, he joined HBO. Were you working with him at the time?
No, he was around, but we didn't ever have much to do. He did write a piece, I think, for Boxing Scene about our little unit that it jokingly called itself Delta Force, because that was the unit that HBO sent everywhere at a minute's notice. Guys like another one of our friends, George Jakovic, and various other folks that... we did all the digital stuff, did all the little fighter segments during everything except a live broadcast, essentially. And so he ended up doing an article about that, and he wanted to interview me about that, but I kept trying to avoid it because I felt like it was unfair, because I was the new boy, and just because I was the one who held a microphone, I didn't think that he should be talking to me about it. There were other people he should be talking
to. Well, that kind of goes where I was going with Hauser, actually. I remember when he was talking about doing The Black Lights, which is obviously one of the great boxing books, he was talking about, you know, one of the reasons he got into it was there was no barrier to entry. You could go to the gyms and speak to these guys. Were you surprised at how easy it was? And were there some surreal situations where you're like, okay, I was wailing a while ago. Yeah. Or not wailing, anti-wailing.
Right, anti-wailing, yeah.
A while ago. And now here I am, and I'm in the gym with this ex.
Yeah.
Were there moments when you were like that? Or I'm ringside, and this is mental.
Yeah, because... Actually, very early on, because I was writing a book and I had an indefinable accent, Lee Samuels at Top Rank, the then PR guy for Top Rank, was like really kind of took me under his wing and was very keen to help. And so he definitely brought me into a lot of the pre-fight stuff for Oscar and Shane. And I was part of a small group of reporters that was invited to Oscar's suite at the MGM in Fight Week. And, you know, there's this whole part of the MGM that people at URI are not allowed in normally. That's where the super high rollers and the celebs and various folks stay. And I remember, first of all, going up in this special elevator and then coming out, and there's this lobby that's specifically for this section of the casino, and there's Carrot Top just sitting there like reading a newspaper or whatever, and I thought, well, okay, that's kind of
Carrot
weird.
Top is like a Vegas house comedian.
Exactly weird looking guy, prop comic, and
a bit like Sideshow Bob, right?
Yeah, exactly. Oh, yeah. That's precisely it. And then we go into Oscar's suite, and there's Oscar. I'm sitting next to Oscar De La Hoya, who has a dog that's smaller than the ones that you hang out with. Like it was some kind of, if you took one of your pugs and shrunk it half size, it's sitting in Oscar's lap. And I just remember thinking the dichotomy of sitting here with this professional world champion boxer and the tiny little teacup Pomeranian or whatever it was he had in his lap. I thought, oh, is this how it's going to be? Is it? This could be interesting. I could stick around for this.
Yeah, because you blend the two things, wildlife and boxing. It's a perfect marriage.
So yeah, that was definitely one, I think. And then after a while, there's the surreal just becomes normal, doesn't it? And I think if it isn't surreal, that's the strange part of it.
Was it pinch yourself stuff when you were lining up with those HBO guys, the big guns, all these Hall of Famers? And I mean, I've got to ask this because I get it regularly. Did you get imposter syndrome? Are you thinking?
I have massive imposter syndrome all the time. I carry that with me tremendously. And I always absolutely have that. And whether I'm with HBO or doing anything, I'm absolutely convinced.
You got it right now?
Little bit. Yeah.
I wish you were someone else. I wish you were Jim.
I do, absolutely. But you know that thing that I loved about HBO, and I was at best a bit part player of a bit part of that whole operation, you know, I don't want to like make it sound like I was any more significant to HBO than I was, but what I always really loved when I worked for HBO was the fact that, you know, I knew I worked with the production team so much that I always like anyway that moment right before a fight, particularly right before a main event when there's that electricity. I grew to really love the moments right before the broadcast going live. Because even though I wouldn't be part of the broadcast, I'd be sitting there with my headphones on and the monitor. And an hour and a half before, we'd all been like at the crew meal, joking around and everything. And then I would sit and I would watch my friends like start to get into positions, start to get their game faces on, know that everyone in the truck was ready to go. You'd see Jim and Max and Roy or Andre kind of getting it together. You'd see Tammy Cotell getting in her groove. I think, yeah, this is pretty good. I feel pretty happy to see my friends kind of get into position and get ready to go, because they would play hard, they would be fun, but when the rubber hit the road, when it's time to work hard, they would work hard, and you knew that they were the best. And I always really loved that. I loved seeing my friends get into position, and I'm like, yeah, all right, let's have a good broadcast. It was
game
exciting.
Time.
Yeah, it's always really exciting.
So mentioned at the top about seeing you doing the Floyd Pacquiao stuff. Obviously, I campaigned for 5 years for Boxing News, left, and then it happened. I've got to say, I was so disenfranchised at the time. I watched it, but like, there wasn't a part of me that wanted to be there, and I mean that wholeheartedly. I remember there was a big card that year, and it was Jorge Linares and Kevin Mitchell, big matchroom bill. Every fight on it was a banger. And I was like, I wanted to be there. And it didn't go to that. But the Mayweather-Pacquiao thing, I was kind of done with it. Obviously, Manny had been sparked by Marquez.
Right.
He didn't look great against Brandon Rios or any number of guys, really, post-Margarito, possibly.
Mm. Yeah, I think the Margarito fight actually damaged him. It was too much. And the Clotty fight, like, even though he won the Clotty fight right beforehand, just moving up to 154 was just too much.
He got lumped and banged up. Yeah, I remember that fight in Arlington, which was that was the first night, by the way, where I spent some time with Bob Arum properly and was thinking, this guy is a machine. Like, I remember we were deep down into the bowels of the Cowboys Stadium, and it was like 12:45 p.m. and my eyes are on stalks, and I'm not jet lagged, so I've been out there for a week,
right.
And I'm thinking I am dead, and he is going
for amazing, isn't it?
Saying about how many, and he's like 80, you know, he would have been about 83-84 years old,
yeah,
and he's
still
doing it now at 91.
Was that where we met, actually? It might have been the first time we actually met face to face, because I remember we were sitting very close to each other ringside for that fight.
Yeah.
And it might have been, like, obviously we knew each other, and I'd probably been writing stuff for you at that stage.
Yeah,
but
it
might
been.
Have been where we first met.
Yeah, I mean, that was a great trip, actually. One of the it was great because I went and found Donnie Fleeman, Muhammad Ali's like fifth or sixth opponent, and Curtis Cokes, and managed to find some of the older guys who subsequently passed. Funny enough, Donnie's daughter, Rhonda Fleeman, weirdly, reached out to me this week. She just found a piece I wrote about Donnie from that visit. So, which I've got to say, it's like one of my career highs. I got it with when Richie Cates passed away recently. I wrote his obituary, and his sons reached out to me from Philadelphia.
Oh wow!
And it's a real. I find that a real buzz, like for them to read about their relatives and
yeah,
stuff.
Yeah, absolutely.
Great. Which so tell me. So sorry, I sort of digressed there. So Floyd Manny, was it anticlimactic for you, or being there and doing it? Were you thinking this is the pinnacle? Like, it don't get no bigger than this. And it was a record-breaking night, let's be honest.
Everything about Fight Week, and indeed the whole build-up to it beforehand, up until the opening bell, was an amazing experience. I mean, we've all done huge Vegas Fight Weeks. It was just off the charts big. It was so electrifying and so exciting, and it was one of the first times that I'd done a lot of other stuff with HBO. Like I hosted the opening press conference and did live streams, you know, from their training camps and all that stuff. So the whole thing was super, super exciting. The atmosphere in the arena was terrible because there were hardly any fans. Fans couldn't afford to be there. It was all Richie
people there for the occasion.
Yep.
Yeah, not for the fight.
Yep. And you just felt the flatness instantly. And it was kind of funny because Jamie Foxx sang the anthem and his earpiece wasn't working, so he was kind of off. Everything was just kind of off. And then the fight, such as it was, happened. And I think Eric Raskin and I, we sat down to do a podcast afterwards, and I think it was Eric who came up with the line that we were hoping we'd get a Manny Pacquiao fight and we got a Floyd Mayweather fight. And that was it. But really, once we walked into that arena and that atmosphere was so flat, and you know what it's like with Vegas undercards anyway, it can be kind of dull, but at least there's normally at least some actual real fight fans in there. Nothing at all. And it was a fight that deserved, obviously it made them a huge amount of money, and that's great, but it deserved a better atmosphere. It deserved a better crowd.
Did you have any good experience or any interesting experiences with Floyd or Manny?
I've had quite a lot with Manny, I suppose. I didn't really have very many with Floyd. I mean, Floyd's
well, he'd
just
done
a
lot of Showtime as well, didn't he?
Yeah, and he
because he had the run-in with Victor Ortiz, didn't he?
Did.
And then Larry, and so that was.
But Floyd also. I mean, Manny, I think part of the deal with Manny was that because I was close with Fred Sternberg, who was his publicist, I'd have the opportunity to get and talk to Manny more. And as you well know, it could be very difficult to get anything out of Manny, but he'd at least sort of, you know, talk to you. And I got to go to Macau a couple of times and sort of follow Manny around. But
yeah, in fact, there's a picture of you and I doing a round table.
Yeah,
with
there
him,
is. That's
and
right.
With Robert Garcia as
yeah,
well.
That's
yeah,
right.
I remember.
Yeah. Yep. And
Macau was off the hook. In
yeah,
fact,
oh my God,
what
Macau
was it?
Amazing.
I don't know if you remember, but we wound up in a pub separately, in the same pub, watching Liverpool.
Oh, that's right.
Do you remember?
Yeah, that's
and it was
right.
A wild game.
Yeah.
I can't remember what it was.
It was Liverpool and Everton.
Yeah, I think it was a derby. Yeah.
Yeah. That's right.
It was like a 3-2 or a 4-3.
Yes, it was. It was absolutely nuts.
And I was like, okay, I wouldn't normally be here, but this is entertaining.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
No,
wow.
I love going to Macau. But, yeah, Floyd was never... I mean, I did some interviews with him, but I don't know if you ever had a different experience, but we felt like he was very selective about who he sort of opened up to or let in, and always found him a bit of a frustrating interview. Like, he could be amenable, right, and perfectly polite and all of that, but I just found him a bit of a challenge.
I found he always, I think I always put a lot of effort into the you know, if you were doing a huddle, I would put a lot of effort into thinking about my questions and trying, whether it was asking him the same thing others wanted to ask, but trying to think of a way that might trigger him or make him pause for thought or give a more considered answer. So if you only get two bites at the cherry, you better be sure that I'm spending half an hour thinking about these questions.
Yeah.
And so I always had good experiences with him in the huddles. And I remember there was one thing, maybe it was the Cotto fight, where he was just sat there and he did everyone. And it was just left with me and him. And we did, you know, maybe up to as many as maybe 10 questions, just he and I. And it was really good free-flowing stuff. I never had any real issues with him, which is ironic given that I think they all hate me because of the book. But it is what it is. You mentioned earlier today in a conversation with me off camera the name Charlie, and that means something very different to me and you than probably people listening who might think Charlie Burley. When you use that, it was to do with Charles Burnick, So tell me how you know Charlie, who obviously is a man that I've spoken to over the years.
I can't remember how I first got in touch with Charlie.
Do you remember why you got in touch with him?
It was very specifically to talk about his research with CTE. Like, he just started that project that he was reaching out to boxers. I think that must have been it. I think he must have... I think, now that I'm thinking about it, there was a Las Vegas fight. I couldn't tell you what fight it was. I do seem to remember it's at the Mandalay Bay. For some reason, I feel like it might have been a Gary Shaw fight, but I don't remember. But someone invited him, it might have been Gary or whoever the promoter was, invited Charlie up onto the dais to talk about what he was doing.
Oh, wow, okay.
And, you know, with my science writing background as well, I thought, oh, well, this will be interesting. And so I did reach out to him, and I did an article for ESPN and talked to a couple of the fighters who were, like, early parts of his study. And then I went back and talked to him a couple more times. He came to D.C. when I was living in D.C. Golden Boy and Top Rank were definitely involved. You'll remember the details of this more than me. And, you know, and sort of trying to encourage funding for his work. And he was at a press conference with Bernard was there. I think Todd DeBuff was there. John McCain. Talking about fighter health, so I talked to him there. And then they had a very early conference.
And Aram's wife, Lovey, was really involved.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then they had a conference on just CTE generally, not specifically boxing and CTE, that I went to. That was one of the first ones that they had that was very interesting, that had, like, Anne McKee and Charlie and various other speakers that I found really interesting. And I thought I was going to pursue it more. And then a shiny object came along and I got distracted and you wrote the book instead.
So it was interesting because obviously when I started doing the research for the book and it was like tying it in and CTE and boxing, there wasn't a whole lot out there. And your article was one of the ones that I saw. So obviously I think I reached out to you and said, hey, I'm doing this book, you know. And I think you might have even told me about, you know, what Charles was like and what I could expect and stuff, which was great. So you kind of answered the question, but when I put you with that article, it made me think, like, are you one of those guys who does get guilt from this and watching it, or is it the science stuff and you're just being a bit of a boffin?
No, I'm massively conflicted about it. I'm constantly conflicted about it. And I don't know how to resolve that conflict, because I'm a huge admirer of the athletes, huge admirer of boxers. I'm drawn to it. The mental and emotional and physical strength of boxers continues to impress me. I love to watch good boxing. I love to watch the skills. And I hate myself for it almost every day. And I don't know how to resolve that. I don't know if it is resolvable, really, other than that, even though I haven't done it for a while, I have done what you do and write about efforts to make it safer and about the health aspects of it and try to show respect for boxers and their health and welfare with everything I write and podcast about. But I, particularly given my background and particularly the friends that I made in my early years, who have a very hard time reconciling these different parts of my life. Like, on the one hand, I'm this, you know, very compassionate person who wants a better, more peaceful planet for us all. And then I'm sitting ringside where I'm waxing, you know, lyrical about when Diego Corrales came back from a bunch of knockdowns to beat Jose Luis Castillo. So, yeah, I don't know. It's a conflict. And it's funny, when I was younger and working for Greenpeace, I was a sort of moral absolutist. And as I've gotten older and gotten involved in this, I'm not anymore. And I don't have a really smart answer for it, other than to say I'm deeply conflicted by it. And I love it, and I respect fighters, and I love fighters, and I kind of hate the business, as most of us do. And I kind of hate myself for being involved in it. But here we are. I mean, it was going to be 6 or 7 months in Las Vegas writing a book, and 20 years later, I'm still here. So,
you say, you know, as well, about that anticipation before the first bell of a big fight. Like, that's hard for us to replace.
Yeah, exactly. You know? That's our equivalent.
And we still get, I get that off the TV even when I'm not at the fights.
Yeah.
You know, you're like, you know, for a good 50-50, you're like, anything can happen.
Yeah.
And we've seen it, even a fight with two non-punchers, whatever, weird, the wonderful, the crazy, the magnificent, the spectacular, like, you just don't know.
Yeah.
You just don't know.
Yeah. It is that moment of anticipation when everybody else leaves the ring and you know the bell's going to ring any minute and they're in their corners and the ref's keeping them in their corners. You're like, here it is. Here we go.
So, you know, we use this phrase in boxing, people going across the street.
Mm-hmm.
You've gone across
the
street.
I've gone across the street.
You're one of the few that's double dipped HBO and Showtime. So how did the Showtime thing come across? Because it wasn't straight from one to the next.
It was pretty swiftly afterwards, actually. When it was pretty obvious that HBO was done. And I can't remember if it was. No, it wasn't even official. It was just very obvious. We all knew internally that the game was up. And I think it was, if I remember correctly, how it happened was Eric Raskin and I had a podcast for HBO, and we were each reaching out to different people to see what the future could hold. And I think it was through Steve Farhood. I think Eric spoke to Steve Farhood, and Steve Farhood said, there's this person, Brian Daly, at Showtime. You could reach out to him.
No, it's all right.
Okay. And, and so I just went and I met him, and I guess they already knew about the podcast, and they were like, yeah, no, absolutely, we'll snap you up. So I don't do all the things for Showtime that I did with HBO. It's a different kind of relationship, but they also, with our podcast, really, you know, our HBO podcast was about HBO fights, and Showtime have us talk about everything, like any fights, like even if there's a Showtime fight, but there's a bigger fight somewhere else, lead with a bigger fight somewhere else. They really want our podcast to be...
Yeah, whether it's books, talking points, news,
they want
whatever.
Us to be... Because obviously they have so much material, but they want our podcast to be the boxing, hardcore boxing fans podcasts and thing for Showtime. So
when we talk across, that thing of being across the street, it's a bit of a cliche. Another cliche is A side and B side.
Right.
So who's the A side and who's the B side? You or Raskin?
Well, Raskin does like to point out that his name comes first in Showtime Boxing with Raskin and Mulvaney, and I just acquiesced to that because I thought it sounded
better.
But
does that mean you're walking second?
Exactly. That's in the contract. I get to pick the microphones.
Oh, that's great. So, but you could never have imagined in your wildest dreams working at HBO that I'm going to go and work for them one day.
You wouldn't
have done, with all due respect, because HBO were the most iconic brand in boxing at the time.
Yeah, and it's funny when you think about how everybody... we talk about fighters not liking each other. There was real mutual antipathy between HBO and Showtime. Bringing together that Mayweather-Pacquiao fight... Getting the broadcasters to agree was on every little detail was as tough as getting the fighters to agree on everything. And there was paranoia on both sides that one network would be doing what it wasn't supposed to do. And back, I mean, there was so much. And so the notion of just like walking, HBO being done and just walking straight over to Showtime was, absolutely not a thought.
Well, I remember doing the podcast with Al Bernstein.
Mm-hmm.
And I sort of got into this thing where I started to slowly hang myself and tried to get him to sort of throw flowers to the HBO team, and he didn't really want to play ball.
No.
I found it super interesting, but it was what it was. Do you think you've got another 20 years left in the game? Is this what you want to be doing?
I don't know if I've got 20 years left, period.
No, but you, in terms of, you know, you mentioned Bert at the top and everything else. Are you going to be doing this? Does the science stuff drag you away?
I'm going to be entirely honest. It's the science stuff is what I love. I love working for National Geographic. I love writing about the Arctic. I love working with Polar Bears International, which is primarily, you know, what I do on that side of the things now. That's what I adore. That's what I love. And weeks like this, when you and I are at the International Boxing Hall of Fame, spending 20 minutes listening to Roberto Duran talk about how one fight in his youth was one of his favorites because then he got to go and have sex with a girl afterwards. That's pretty damn special. I would not like to give up these kind of experiences. I hope that I'm still able to do this for a long time. There are times where I think about, God, I just don't want to be involved in boxing anymore. And I think a lot of that is due to my moral conflict. But then we have experiences like this, or then we're around fighters and then I'm at a big fight and I get the buzz all over again.
Just one last one in closing. The HBO final broadcast.
Yeah.
It set in motion sporting mourning. Mm. It must have been very, very difficult to do. Obviously, Jim was in pieces. And no one wanted to go out. And it went out with a whimper. Like, horrible. Not great fights.
Horrible.
Not the biggest names. And yeah. it was almost like watching some sort of boxing funeral.
Yeah.
Was it horrible to be part of in that respect?
It was horrid. We knew pretty much that it was done with the Golovkin-Canelo rematch. We knew that was going to be the last pay-per-view. And then it became official, I think, just 10 days to 2 weeks after that. And our very final fight was at what was then still StubHub, where there'd been so many legendary fights. Mm. Right? It was renowned for being just such a great arena with great fights. And it was a Cecilia Brækhus fight. And the arena was maybe half full. And no disrespect to Cecilia Brækhus, who I think is terrific, but for a final HBO fight...
When you think of the legendary nights, you think of your Hopkins, your Joneses, Gatti, Wards, Barrera, Morales, Cotto, everything.
And the fact that it was 2,000, 3,000 people in the arena, it was an... there were tears.
And no one wanted to be there in those circumstances. No. Tough.
No, there were definitely a lot of...
Is that the hardest night of your career?
Boxing wise, yeah, I think it might have been. It was really, really sad. I hadn't, it was become a family. Yeah, because you know how we like to all see each other at different fights, and it's kind of fun. But these were the exact same people that we went to every fight together and did stuff between fights and all that kind of stuff. And it was a great team, and it was horrible. It was really, really, really horrible.
Well, I hate to end on a negative, but it's been, like you said, it's been fabulous out here at the Hall of Fame. It was great hearing Roberto Duran absolutely flying through 20 minutes of an interview with you. That, was meant to be in a little pokey, little curtained off area, but you actually ended up with a standing crowd. It's like boxing's Woodstock. Everyone came around to listen to you interviewing Duran. So hopefully that's a career high, having talked about one of those.
You know, it's so funny. Just as you were talking about that, I'm like, that will go down as a highlight. Yeah. I will not forget that moment. That was pretty amazing.
One-on-one with Duran, with a crowd who were basically whooping and hollering after every answer. Yeah. It was fantastic. Yeah. So anyway, look, thanks so much for making the time to do this. I really appreciate it. Thanks, Kieran.
Thanks a lot, mate.
For being a colleague and a pal, mate.
Thanks, mate. Cheers, mate. Really appreciate it.
So I think you can tell I enjoyed every minute of that. It was funny at the end there talking about the Raskin and Mulvaney duo at Showtime. Eric is a good pal as well. Always had a lot of time for Eric. In fact, I know he's listened to this podcast before because he shouted out the Paul Spadafora podcast a few months ago on Twitter. And I'm sure he will have a wry chuckle when we're talking about the A side and B side. But they're a great duo, guys. Go out and check out their Showtime boxing podcast. They are one of the best podcast duos around when it comes to the sport of boxing. And highly entertaining. So that was great with Kieran. Huge thanks to Kieran for making the time to do it. He was there with me, working with me for Pro Box. So it's not like he really went out of his way to do it, but still, I suppose I better say I'm grateful. I am grateful to Hanson Lee Resourcing. They were voted the UK's best specialist insurance sector recruitment firm at the Corporate Excellence Awards. Not only do they find you the best people, but Hanson Lee help you retain them. And you can find out more at hansonlee.com. Visit my Patreon, patreon.com/TrisDixon, and I'll be back next week.